bring the public safety and security policy and finance meeting to half order. We won't take any official action. Okay, I guess we have a quorum. So we'll bring the meeting to order and start out with a roll call.
Representative Cornish.
Here.
Representative Johnson.
Here.
Representative Hillstrom.
Here.
Representative Becker-Finn.
Here.
Representative Considine. Representative Dean. Representative Frankie.
Here.
Representative Grossel.
Here.
Representative Howe. Representative Lohmer. Representative Lucero.
Here.
Representative Neuberger. Representative O'Neill.
Here.
Representative Pinto. Representative Ward.
Here.
Representative Zerwas.
Here.
Okay, members, we need an approval of the minutes for January 31st. Representative Zerwas moves the meeting minutes for January 31st. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay. Today we will have the Post Board, the Sentencing Guidelines, and the Board of Public Defense in front of us. We'll start out with the Peace Officer Standards and Training Board, Post Board. Mr. Gove, welcome. To give your name and title and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Nathan Gove. I'm the Executive Director of the Peace Officer Standards and Training Board, known as the Post Board. And when I appeared before you several weeks ago to provide an agency overview, I explained our base budget and how that is funded through the special revenue account, which I have given you a handout that is more in depth than what I could fit on one of my slides. In addition to the special revenue account, we also have then that DWI reinstatement for non-DWI DL suspensions that generates approximately $125,000 a year. And at that time, in the current fiscal year, we had a $100,000 appropriation by the legislature for de-escalation training statewide, which will conclude at the end of 2017. Just as a review on our key services that we do, the main items is certainly we license and relicense over roughly 12,000 peace officers in Minnesota, both active and inactive. We have completely rewritten and continue to revise our learning objectives. We approve ongoing in-service training for officers across the state, and we monitor agency compliance with the mandated policies and procedures. And one of the main items is we administer a partial training reimbursement fund for local units of government. I'll refer to the budget papers that you have, I believe, in front of you on the 2018-2019 biennial budget. And this lists our fiscal year recommendation from the governor, with an increase in our base through the special revenue, the non-DWI DL reinstatement, as well as a one-time $5 million governor-recommended appropriation for training for peace officers across Minnesota. This would be $5 million in each of the fiscal years. With this, there would be $7.8 million roughly per fiscal year, which would be 85% of our overall budget to be returned to local units of government. This would increase the per-officer share to roughly $860 per fiscal year. And by comparison, if you talk about a 40-hour crisis intervention team training certification, that's around $650 in the metro to $800 just for tuition alone.
Mr. Gove, and just for personal input, I might have mentioned to you this before, I'm not sold on the 40-hour course. There's courses that are shorter, and that's a huge expense of money and time to take a person off the road, but we'll talk about that down the line. Thank you.
Yes, indeed, Chairman. The shows the budget recommended by the governor for fiscal year 19 as well. And just by, as a matter of so for our fiscal year 2018 and 19, this is our approximate per fiscal year operating expenses for the Post Board. Mostly, as you can see, it covers employee compensation benefit costs and expected increases as well. The remainder, the $206,000, is split between ongoing rent for our office space, as well as the just over $100,000 divided between the main items of our in-state travel costs for our standards coordinators, doing the agency site visits, our communications for our computers, hookups with the state, our centralized IT services as well, statewide indirect costs, and our attorney general costs and supplies. And this chart is the current proceeds from the special revenue account and the estimates on what will go back to the general fund. Again, the Post Board receives 39% of the original $25 surcharge, or $9.75. The surcharge is now at $75. 65 of that goes to the general fund. You can see what the estimates are beginning in 2017 on the training account and what the Post Board budget is recommended and proposed. And the general fund transfer on the far right column, that is in addition to what's not budgeted to the Post Board. Our non-DWI reinstatement fee, this was enacted back in and implemented in 2007, and you can see how the receipts have continued to decline. We're estimating $105,000 for fiscal year 2017, which would be about $10,000 under that $125,000. Here is the current reimbursement going back to 2010. I believe members have a larger chart going back approximately 20 years, but you can see the volatility of this fund in terms of the per officer share. 2016, it decreased over $20. So the governor has recommended a one-time funding split between the biennium of $10 million to support and strengthen law enforcement education and train to better protect all Minnesotans. Certainly the board supports this. There has been an ongoing decline in the reimbursement, yet an increase in the areas that communities, elected sheriffs, and appointed police chiefs need to provide to their peace officers across the state to meet those community needs. This is particularly important for the greater Minnesota. Again, 75% of the agencies in Minnesota have 25 or less officers. 19 of them, as of today, have one officer. Their training budgets, while you might see a larger agency in the metro where the reimbursement is a smaller fraction of their total training costs, certainly in greater Minnesota, in smaller agencies, it makes up a much larger share. And we see that consistently through our biennial report as to the impact that that makes on their officers, not just in terms of tuition, but the overall cost to get officers to training, to backfill, to have coverage, to maintain that consistent public safety for their communities.
Yeah.
Concerning compensation funding, the governor recommends a $42,000 increase to our budget over the biennium to cover expected compensation increases. This will cover anticipated growth and benefits as well, employer-paid health care, pension contributions, Social Security, Medicare tax. The governor has also recommended $100,000 in each fiscal year for a total of $200,000 to support a post-board initiative concerning our outreach coordinator position. And this is important as when I took over at the post board several years ago, we did formalized strategic planning for the board and spoke to our stakeholders and heard loud and clear that the post board needed to become more robust in areas of technology and information, not only in data provided to our law enforcement customers, but the public, government officials as well. And this is an area that I think is very important for us, and it aligns with the strategic initiative by our board to ensure that people in Minnesota, both citizens and public officials, understand the role, the capacity of the post board. And this position would be very critical for me and my staff, especially maintaining, for instance, our web content, which changes literally on a daily basis to support our printed publications, traditional, and look at opportunities with social media, coordinate our legislative reporting requirements, and provide communication and research to our staff. In addition to this position or responsibilities, certainly to have a robust role through our education coordinator with our 29 professional peace officer education programs across the state to help them facilitate and expand opportunities for non-traditional candidates as agencies try to attract non-traditional diverse candidates into the law enforcement field. There are current pathways in process to this, and this would be very helpful to have more of a centralized role and output on this from the post board itself.
Director, the that slide there, I'm a fan of this position, but why is it funded at such a high rate? Usually an FTE doesn't come near that just for a or what kind of equipment are you including in there? What's in that estimation, that just one position for $200,000?
Yeah, yes, Mr. Chair and members, it's funded at a the high end of $100,000 combined between the salary and related office equipment setup expenses. That is a professional MAPE position, and that was a recommendation of my budget officer on the funding cost of that on the high end.
That would be an outreach position under you, right? You'd be the still be the director. This would be serving
yes,
you.
Yes, that is correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay. We'll take a look at that. Representative Hilsman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that amount, it includes the pay, the benefits, and all of the other insurance that goes along with it. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, that's correct.
Thank you.
That's $100 a year, $200 for the biennium?
That's all correct, right. Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you. Okay. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and perhaps we'll be getting into this later. I would really like to know a little bit more about the training that is being offered and is required. What are the requirements for the various training components? And I'm particularly interested in the gun range issues because of a gun range in my district that has been worked on for 20 years plus, and it's really a challenge to the community, and it used heavily by a great number of units. So I would just, I don't know whether you want to talk about it now or whether that would be covered later or whether we should have a private conversation, but I think knowing what the requirements are in all of these training issues would be very helpful to me.
Mr. Grove, are you aware of the subject that Representative Ward is talking about or that specific range? Or?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ward, I am not aware of the specific firearms range issues.
Representative Ward, you can go ahead and address this if you'd like.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ramsey County, Maplewood. St. Paul has leased this property about 30 years ago for $1 a year. And development all around it is significant. A lot of housing areas all around it. So it's used by a great number of units around the metropolitan area because it's an outdoor range and wooded and with hills and gives them a lot of opportunities for the kind of training we want our officers to have. But it's also had a huge negative impact on the communities because when they started this, most of the training was with pistols. And that's not true anymore. A lot of heavier armaments and, starting early in the morning, we've limited it now to generally not before 8 and generally not after 5 or 6 in the evening, though sometimes it is nighttime stuff too, and sometimes it's weekends. So that people are not really able to enjoy being out in their backyards, having picnics, going for walks in their neighborhoods. It sounds like a war zone. So my question really is, what is the requirements? I understand a lot of communities are building their own ranges. So I think there needs to be some kind of conversation about not only what the expectations are, but how are we doing systemically providing opportunities for training so that we don't have individual communities investing in training facilities. And we have all of these cropping up and impacting communities.
Mr. Gold.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ward, I can tell you that the training is very meeting the post-board minimum use of force training requirements, which is an annual requirement, is left to the elected sheriffs and the appointed police chiefs as minimum standards that we require in this area, in addition to officers training on the types of equipment they carry on their utility belts. But pertaining to firearms, there is a handgun and an auxiliary a long gun type of a component, but it is not excessive in what is required in terms of the minimum requirements. It is for the communities to determine, depending on the type of auxiliary or long gun type weaponry that they issue to their officers. So the board does not, these have been relatively unchanged for many years. However, our training committee is looking at making sure that they're appropriately updated, but I do not feel there will be substantial changes. So this is a question for the local agencies, as we do require that officers shoot at varying distances that they might encounter. And the whole purpose is for accuracy, of course, and that they have some training in low light so that they can demonstrate proficiency and accuracy during darkness and other types of requirements. But concerning as far as the building of that, we haven't seen a major change in our requirements for many, many years on that.
We'll continue to talk about that, Representative Ward. Thank you. Okay. You got one more slide?
I believe this is my last slide, and I was just going to ask if there's any additional questions on the areas that I have talked about concerning this. I'm certainly very hopeful that we'll receive support in the areas that have been outlined and recommended by the governor.
Mr. Grove, Director, we'll do our best. I know the $10 million that the governor has proposed seems to be a pretty popular bipartisan proposal on carrying the bill, and there's all sorts of legislators from both sides on there. Whether we'll be able to meet the $10 million level or not is to be determined in the future, but the bill seems to be very popular at any rate for now. Any questions from the members about the post board? Thank you very much for your proposal.
Thank you.
For your presentation. Now we have Nate Reitz from the Executive Director of the Sentencing Guidelines Commission for the budget review. Welcome, Mr. Reitz. If you want to give your name and title once you get your computer plugged in. We'll
good morning, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Nate Reitz, and I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission. Thank you for inviting me back to discuss the agency's budget with you this morning. The 11-member Sentencing Guidelines Commission employs 6 full-time staff members, myself, 2 senior research analysis specialists, 1 intermediate research analyst, and 1 entry-level research analyst, as well as 1 management analyst for. 3 of the 6 staff members have been employed by the commission for over 15 years, and 1 just hit the 30-year mark 2 months ago. Consistent with this agency's history, in fiscal year 2018 through 19, compensation of those 6 full-time employees will continue to be the single largest expenditure by category. As this chart shows, 90% of the agency's base budget for fiscal year 2018-19 is compensation. With respect to the remaining 10%, the majority of the agency's operating expenses fund the rent of our office space, which is over in the administration building, as well as minute and other technology requirements that our researchers in particular require. The agency's staff's statutory duties may be said to fall into one of 2 focus areas. The first focus area, which is shown on the left side of this slide, slide 3, is in ensuring the continued successful operation of Minnesota's sentencing guidelines. I spoke about the benefits to the state of Minnesota of the sentencing guidelines, you'll recall, last month. We support the commission with research and administrative support as it continually works to improve the guidelines, and we support practitioners around the state as they attempt to accurately implement the guidelines in over 16,000 felony cases annually, individually reviewing the sentencing worksheet in each one of those 16,000-plus cases. The second focus area, shown on the right side of this slide, is serving as a clearinghouse and information center for sentencing practices data. We provide a wide variety of reports on sentencing practices to policymakers, academics, practitioners, and the general public, including assistance in the preparation of fiscal notes and racial impact statements to the legislature. Effective August 1st of 2016, the legislature gave this agency a new requirement to collect and analyze information regarding the impact of changes to drug laws, including the Drug Sentencing Reform Act that was passed last year. I'll talk about this new requirement on the next slide. The Drug Sentencing Reform Act changed the drug quantity thresholds for certain drugs. To fully understand and evaluate the impact of the act, then, it is necessary to know not just the degrees of offenses charged, which is the sort of information that we have historically tracked, but also the actual quantity and type of drugs involved in cases, both before the act was implemented and after the act was implemented, in addition to other offense characteristics. Getting this information will involve individually reading over 5,000 criminal complaints each year, both historically and going forward, and to analyze the data gleaned from these complaints. To allow us to accomplish this new task, the legislature funded 1/2 of an entry-level research analyst position, which is now reflected in our base budget that I showed you previously. This slide shows the governor's recommended biennial budget for FY 2018 to 19. And this is slide 5. The governor's request recommends funding the agency at $51,000 above base to maintain the current level of service delivery. No new staffing positions are being requested. This operating increase is primarily driven by the compensation cost increases that the governor is anticipating. regarding those compensation costs, this slide shows a little bit of historical perspective on what our staffing levels have been over the past decade. The green line shows the number of full-time employees per 10,000 felony cases sentenced annually, and I do that because the number of felony cases sentenced annually is a primary or a major driver of our day-to-day workload. That number has been at or below 4 employees per 10,000 cases since 2011, and we can maintain that approximate level with 6 full-time employees. The blue line shows the number of full-time employees that we've had over the past decade. The agency has had 6 or sometimes 5 full-time employees since 2010. It had more employees prior to that. Due to increasing compensation costs, it had been increasingly difficult in recent years to maintain the 6th employee on a permanent basis. But last year's addition of half of a research analyst enabled us once again to do so. So upon receiving that appropriation, we did fund fund that research analyst position. I would like to point out that these increasing compensation costs are outside the agency's control. The current configuration of the 6 employees is exactly the same as it was in 2012, and no one has been promoted to a higher position since they were in 2012. Mr. Chair, subject to your questions, that concludes the budget presentation of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission.
Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Who are the 650 practitioners?
Regarding the...
that you train annually.
Well, our management analyst, who's also our trainer, is here. But we do webinars. They are prosecutors, defense attorneys, judges, but I would say probation officers who actually have to do the sentencing worksheet are most of the people who receive the training, and probably the people for whom it's most important to receive the training. But we also do prosecutor. We also train prosecutors, judges, and defense attorneys.
Thank you.
Representative Hillsborough.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in the report that you're doing on the drug sentencing changes, sentencing guidelines usually only tracks felonies. Are you still keeping track of the gross misdemeanors that used to be felonies that now are grosses?
Director Wright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hillstrom, that is correct. And I didn't get into all the details on what the new requirement does as far as a new workload, but that is something that we haven't had to do before, is track gross misdemeanors. So we are going to be tracking those new gross misdemeanor offenses. The fifth degree controlled substance crime now contains a gross misdemeanor category, which is a new thing. Normally, that would sort of drop off our radar at that point, but we are going to continue to track those gross misdemeanors, which is, you know, requires a new way of doing things for us.
Okay, any other questions, members? Okay, go ahead, Mr. Wright. Director Wright.
Mr. Chair, subject to any other questions, that's the conclusion of my presentation.
What's that?
I have no further slides, Mr. Chair.
Okay, folks, nothing? Thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next, we have the Board of Public Defense, Chief Administrator Kevin Kyer, and State Public Defender Bill Ward. Welcome, gentlemen, and whoever would like to begin with the name and title. And
Mr. Chairman and members, thank you. My name is Kevin Kyer. I'm the Chief Administrator for the Board of Public Defense. With me is Bill Ward, the State Public Defender. In your packets, Mr. Chairman, hopefully you have our presentation. We're going to go, as we did last week, a little old school with you in terms of using the paper. As you may recall from our presentation, Mr. Chairman, we are the largest user of the court system. We handle about 145,000 cases a year. And provide mandated services in every county and every courtroom in the state of Minnesota. As we talked about last week, public defenders cannot refuse cases, and that's going to be important as we talk a little bit more about the budget and where we are budget-wise and with the governor's recommendation as well. I know you wanted to talk a little bit, Mr. Chairman, about the base budget in the presentation on page 4 of our handout. This is a the document or graph that you saw a little bit last week, we have an $82 million a year budget for 2017. About a little over 90% is on our district level public defense. About 3% is in our administrative services office. We run that $82 million a year operation with 10 administrative people in our administrative services office, six of whom are technology people. To give you a little perspective, and again, in different states there are different responsibilities. I think in the state of Wisconsin there are 31 people in the central office. In the state of Maryland there are actually 46 people who run that public defender operation. On page 5, you can see the breakdown of the budget by item. Again, we talked a little bit about this last week. About 90% of the budget is personnel. About 6% is what we call our mandated costs. Again, rent, data lines, phone lines, appellate transcripts, district court transcripts, mileage, and our computer services. Mileage is, you may recall, we put on a lot of miles. We have about half of our staff outside of the metro area is part-time, so they are running from jail to courthouse to office to jail. We pay about $900,000 a year in mileage costs to get those folks to and from the courthouses. To give you a little perspective, Mr. Chairman and members, on page 6, of the total budget request or the new money that we're requesting, about $12 million over the biennium for salary increases, mandated insurance costs, and mandated retirement costs is about the equivalent of 54 positions, entry-level positions, in the first year and about 86 positions in the second year of the biennium.
Mr. Geyer, I noticed that your estimate for an FTE come in about $18,000 cheaper than the post board.
Mr. Chairman, that's our entry-level salaries, about a little over $55,000 a year for an attorney. We're assuming family coverage for insurance there, and obviously Social Security, Medicare, those things. So, yeah, it's a little over $82,000.
Attorneys are getting paid less than an outreach course. Okay, thank you. You're right.
Mr. Chairman, the budget request itself.
Bilstrom had a comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You are fully in control of the ability to change that.
Exactly. Yeah, I don't know how much we want to bring that other one down, though. Just kidding. Go ahead, Mr. Carter.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not here to advocate for you to bring that one down. And on page 7 starts the actual budget request, Mr. Chairman. As those of you who have been around a little bit and those of you who we've talked to, there was on our history of the board, we've had a tremendous roller coaster, if you will. In 2003, 2005, and again in 2008 and 2009, we've had staffing reductions. And what would happen is we'd have the staffing reductions, we would come back, there would be a little money provided. We'd be able to kind of either continue with our staff or maybe hire a few people. In 2013 and 14, we put together a three-biennium plan. And the three-biennium plan was if we could get ourselves to 75% of the number of attorneys that the state and national standards recommend, we would be able to cover first appearances in all of the counties in the state. If you look at page 9, the maps on page 9, and some of you have seen this as we visited individually with you, this is where we were in 2013. The blue counties are the counties where we were actually at first appearance on a regular basis. The yellow counties are where we were not there, and the orange counties where we were there some of the time. That to us, frankly, was unacceptable. We are embarrassed by it, and it doesn't do well, frankly, for either clients or the court system. If we're not there at first appearance, all it does is push that case out further. The jails become more crowded, particularly in in-custody. The counties are paying more time for people to spend in jail than maybe they would ordinarily not have to. So we came up on that or put together that three-biennium plan. The governor and the legislative leadership in both parties have been very bipartisan, said, yes, this is something we want to do. Mr. Chairman, with your help, with Representative Hillstrom's help, with a number of folks, we've been able to make some progress on that, and this is the third biennium. So on page 10 is actually the budget request, and it really consists of six different items within there. Attorney staffing. We are asking for an additional 19 new lawyers each year of the biennium. Salary increases of 3.5%, which is, I believe, what the court is asking you to provide for the judges and for court administration. You've heard about the mandated insurance cost increases from the other folks that have come before you, as well as the retirement increases. The last two pieces, one is the sentencing advocates, and we'll talk a little bit about that in a minute, and also our public defense corporations. Excuse me. Mr. Chairman, if you all would turn to page 11, you can see what those maps look like today after our first two bienniums of this plan. We went from having lawyers at in-custody first appearances in 23 counties to today 75 counties. The yellow county in the middle of the state, Morrison County, has just turned blue in the last 30 or 60 days. So I guess we're here to tell you we told you we were going to do something, and we actually went out and did it. We've also made some progress on the out-of-custody cases. Obviously, as we told you last biennium, and frankly the biennium before, the in-custody were the top priority, and so that's where we focused our efforts. There are three counties down on the Iowa border in yellow, which our chief public defender right now is working with those counties to hopefully be able to do some of this in-custody work with ITV. So far, we haven't been able to get that accomplished, but he's continuing to work on that.
Director.
Mr. Chairman, on page 12, you can see
The back on the 10th slide here, do you have pay grids in your salaries? If so, steps and lanes collect some, or if so, how many and how are they work out?
Mr. Chairman, as I mentioned, our entry-level salary is about a little over $55,000. The top of the range is about $103,000. There are 19 steps to go from the entry-level to the top, and those steps are not automatic. Those are negotiated every 2 years in the contracts we have with Teamsters Local 320. So they really are subject to you all in terms of the funding that you know you can come up with for us.
Thank you. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And isn't it true that the lawyers in the public defender's office are actually at some of the lowest pay scales of any lawyers in government?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hillstrom, that's correct. If you can see on our chart on page 13, relative to the Attorney General, which is the other statewide agency, if you will, that employs an awful lot of lawyers, we're significantly below those. For the most part, except for a number of the smaller counties, obviously, our starting salary is lower than the county attorneys.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, so again, on page 12, you can see what the additional staffing would bring us to. It would bring us to the 73% of the caseload standards the first year and 75% of the caseload standards the second year. On page 13, again, is the chart relative to salaries. And again, we're asking for that 3.5%, which is the same that the court is asking for. Again, we talked about on page 14 the increase in our insurance costs. Yes.
Representative Becker-Finn had a
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So back to page 12.
Yes.
Just wondering, just for our education, what would it take, you know, how much money would it take to actually get to 100%? Because, you know, as much as I'm worried about the public defenders, I'm more concerned about the citizens of Minnesota who aren't being served. So just wondering what that number would actually look like.
Director Carter.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Becker-Finn, I don't have it right off the top of my head. I will tell you that we're asking for 38 new lawyers to move the dial, if you will, 5%. So if you just extrapolating that out, you're probably looking at, my guess is 130 to 150 lawyers, somewhere in there, at $82,000 apiece. So it's a lot.
Yeah. Thank you.
All right, Mr. Clare, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, as I mentioned on page 14, the insurance cost increases, that, of course, is nothing new. You all are dealing with that or have dealt with that. As I mentioned last week in the presentation, this is a big, big deal for our folks in greater Minnesota, most of whom are part-time. They don't do it because they're getting rich. They don't do this work. They're doing it. Yes, there's a paycheck, but the big thing is the affordability and accessibility to health insurance. The 1.5% increase in retirement contributions, that's obviously contingent on you all passing a retirement reform bill. I know you had it most of the way up the hill last year and kind of collapsed at the end of session. I'm assuming, and I talked to the retirement funds, that they are going to be coming back and asking for that same retirement reform bill, which will be effective July 1st of 2017. And that bill will include, as I've been told, that 1.5% increase. Mr. Chairman, at page 15, we are also asking for, as I mentioned, 7 dispositional advisors. Again, as we talked about last week, and it's nothing new to the folks in this committee, we are seeing more and more people with mental health issues, more and more folks with chemical dependency issues. And we had a training for some of our newer employees last week, and I mentioned I had this slide in a presentation I did, and they almost to a person said that estimate is low in terms of the number of folks they deal with that have mental health issues. And those are just our new people. Those aren't the folks that have been around for a while. The dispositional advisors are the folks, or what we call dispositional advisors, or sentencing advocates, provide for alternative sentences, just like the name indicates. They're the ones that find the treatment programs. They're the ones that find the medications or the medication protocols. They're the ones that have the time, frankly, to do those, and the expertise to do those things, to hopefully keep people out of prison or out of jail and get them on the right path.
Mr. Carter.
Right now, we are operating with about half of the number of dispositional advisors that we should have.
Representative Hilstrom had a question. Starter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize because I'm going to take you back a little bit. So on slide number 12, you're talking about the additional attorney positions that you need based on the public defender staffing and the national standards. And I went through your slideshow presentation, and I don't see anything about the increase in children that you represent in the CHIPS cases. And we've been hearing in the press that those caseloads are going tremendously high, and I don't see a request in here for any other staff for support of those as well. Can you get us the numbers about that caseload as well? Because I assume when we mandate that you represent children over the age of 10, that may have an impact on your caseload numbers as well that aren't taken into account. And I assume there is no money anywhere else in anyone's budget. So I assume it is this committee that is funding all of that work as well.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hilstrom, we can certainly get you those numbers. Obviously, the big impact there is in the parents, which are the counties represent, and we're seeing that a lot, particularly in Hennepin County. But we are projecting about a 1% increase overall in caseloads over the next 2 years. The misdemeanor cases are down, but as you indicated, the child protection cases are up. So that's included in kind of in our request to get to the 75%, but we'll certainly provide you with those numbers.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So there's a bill that's out there requiring that the child themselves waive their right to a lawyer. So you may want to watch, because I would bet that will have an impact on your numbers. And given that you're already mandated to represent them, I would think that's kind of already taken into account. So you might want to keep an eye on your numbers and let us know.
Director Carter.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hilstrom, we are aware of that. In fact, we've had some talks with the folks who are pushing that bill, so, and we do have some concerns about it. So we will be continue to talk to them.
Well, Mr. Chair, one last comment.
Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm strongly supportive of you representing all of those children, and so I guess my best advice would be let us know what it is that it would cost because you are, in fact, mandated to provide that service.
Hey, Director Carter, you were in the middle of something about the chemical dependency issue.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, on the again, on the dispositional advisors, we're operating right now with a little over 50% of the number of those sentencing advocates or dispositional advisors that the national and state standards would say we should have. The request would bring us up to right around 60 to 65% of that standard. So, as I said, we are seeing more and more of those types of cases or those situations in the cases we deal with. The last piece of the first budget request is a 5% increase each year for the four public defense corporations. These are, as you may recall from last week, there are four nonprofits that frankly predate the Board of Public Defense that provide service to minority communities in various parts of the state. And a panel about 4,000 cases a year but for these corporations, those would be public defender cases. Mr. Chairman, the second request.
Director, there's a Representative Pinto has a question.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I meant to ask this before. Just, Director, I'm just trying to, I'm curious about what the advantage is of sending cases to the corporations or having them in place versus having them come through the public defense system. I've worked on a number of cases with NJC, the Neighborhood Justice Center. I've always wondered what the need is for that separate set of institutions in that way.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pinto, it's not a matter of sending cases there. It's a matter of folks have that option that they will, you know, those doors are open to them. As I said, three of the four corporations were started pre a statewide public defender system, and really the thought was that the judicial system as a whole was not particularly friendly to people of color.
Okay.
And they were community-based. They kind of grew out of just kind of a grassroots effort, if you will. We provide about half the funding. Or I should say you all provide about half the funding for the corporations. The rest of it is through grants, through whatever money they can scrape together, just like civil legal services.
And, Mr. Chair.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so can you just give a sense then as to, because I gather there's a financial benefit on top of other things to then having them in place and be raising those outside funds and they probably work at a different level, et cetera. Can you just talk a little more about the advantage then of having them in place parallel to the public defense system?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Pinto, it is obviously the 4,000 cases, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that they take. It also is, as I said, it's an option for folks, Minneapolis, St. Paul, Duluth, particularly folks on the Earth, White Earth and Leech Lake reservations that have that. There is still a great deal of distrust among minority community members, particularly when you go up to White Earth and Leech Lake, of the judicial system as a whole. So it is a outlet, if you will, it's a safety valve, if you will, for those folks. Again, they're all community-based, so a lot of the lawyers, the folks that work in there live in those areas. They know those people. It's a great advantage, to them to have that option available to them. They work on pretty much the same standards we do in terms of eligibility,
right.
Those kinds of things. They do have the advantage to be able to raise private funding, although they've seen a number of those avenues dry up in the last few years. So those are kind of the main ones, if you will.
That's helpful background. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, the second request relates to changes in the court system. We're asking for a 11 full-time equivalent legal secretary assistants to deal with changes in the court system relative to technology. You would expect that that would be a cost savings. It is not, at least not for us. And I think, I don't recall if it was here or in the Senate, I had mentioned last week that the most cost-effective way for us to do our job continues to be paper. To get a paper file, get an email file, and that we're able to then print and either bring into the jail, give to the client because it is his or her file, and storage costs are relatively outside, at least outside of the metro area, relatively cheap.
Director, yep. How did you ever come out on that hubbub we had back a while ago about who had to furnish the documents and who had to pay for them and transcription and things? You remember that, Representative Hillstrom?
I do remember.
How did that turn out?
Well, Mr. Chairman, there have been a lot of hubbubs over the years relative to who pays for what. I believe, and Representative Hillstrom might be able to correct me, is you're talking about the pretrial appeals? Is that? Yes, I'm not quite sure which hubbub we're talking about.
You getting the documents from the county attorney and who was supposed to pay for the reproduction or something like that, or maybe that was a local issue.
Mr. Chair, as far as the statute's concerned, the county attorney is to reproduce the documents for us, so that part of it has not been an issue. Transcripts, on the other hand, have been an issue as far as it used to be that certainly with pleas and sentencing, those were provided automatically until the mid-2000s, and after that time, they were no longer transcribed. If we wanted a copy of the transcript, we pay a reduced rate for the Public Defender's Agency, but we have to pay for every page of transcript we're asking for. And certainly if cases are appealed or there's a post-litigation after a plea, we're paying for those transcripts as well.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To give some clarification, the last controversy over payment was their budget, they run out of the ability to pay for those transcripts quite frequently before the end of the year. And so it was part of our task to make certain that they had the money set aside to actually pay for those transcripts. Mr. Chair, that's only going to increase. And I believe that they're going to have additional issues with storage and transcripts as there's more and more body camera video because the Public Defense Board, one, has to store them, but two, you actually have to watch all of that video. And then some of the courts across the state are starting to say things like, you can't enter into evidence that video unless a complete transcript is provided. So, therefore, if the Public Defense Board wants to put forward the video for their case, they have to have someone transcribe the entire video. If the state wants to put forward that video, they have to pay someone to transcribe it. So as there's more hours and hours of body camera video in these cases, they are going to have more and more challenges with producing the information that they need to actually try these cases.
Representative Hillstrom, yeah, I heard that too. The other day, law enforcement came up and said that there was, I think, three or four judges that have making rulings that the whole body camera tape had to be transcribed. And it could be very expensive, time-consuming.
Correct, Mr. Chair. One of the reasons is because if you play any portion of a video, a defendant has the right to say there's a rule against its entirety, and they can ask that the entire thing be played. Well, you can't play it if you don't have a transcript for it. And so, yes, that is becoming a significant issue. Significant issue.
It's kind of scary to think of your body camera tapes being transcribed. I remember I was one of the first game wardens that had a VCR in my truck. You hit the on button, you'd see the whole thing, and sometimes the judges weren't too thrilled with my narration of the event.
Mr. Chair, that is, if you play any of it, the defendant has the right to have it played in its entirety.
I found that out. Mr. Tiger, go ahead.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, what we used to get, as I indicated, and what we've talked about, what we used to get on paper, what we used to get, frankly, with an email attachment where you could download and print, we now have to go in and find ourselves, in fact, on the appellate side, actually make the record. I've got a short video here. I hope it will work because it shows you one appellate file what has to be done. And this was not a particularly large appellate file. And I bet it's not going to. It's not going to go. But what happens is, Chairman, is you have to go in, click on each document. You have to highlight the selected documents you want, print them to the printer, go and pick them up, make sure that the document isn't mixed with other printing jobs, and then manually date and collate those. Again, and I'm not here to cast aspersions on the court. I know what trouble they had putting together this. But it really, for an agency that has 145,000 cases a year, it's just not a very cost-effective means of doing business.
Mr. Chair, if I could put this in context. By rule, if a person has a right to appeal a judgment against them in criminal court, by rule, the court would put together what they would call, quote-unquote, the record. And that record would be provided to us, again, as Kevin said, either in paper format in the past or by electronically. Well, now the new rules are we have to go and find what that record is and compile our own record. And that is incredibly time-consuming as these cases come into our appellate office. So that's the video, and it's literally 5 minutes of going through MGA and finding what we believe the record is, and then copying those documents, printing them out, and then collating them in a way that makes sense as far as either by date or correspondence or certainly pleas and other motions that were filed. So that's the shift. And, again, it's not a diss on the court. That's a shift in what our responsibilities have become as far as compiling the record for the appeal to begin. And, again, clients have the right to appeal a finding of guilty.
Mr. Chairman, the other piece of it is, as we mentioned last week, we are embarking on an electronic content management system. There's a diagram in your packet. I guess the best one is actually pages 23 and 24. We will be rolling out in a first judicial district sometime this spring, hopefully the 1st of April, where prosecutors will either be able to email or directly upload documents into our content management system, which would then put those documents into the file for our lawyers in our current case management system. We're requesting $200,000 a year for electronic storage of those documents. Again, as I indicated before, paper is the most effective for us and the most cost-effective for us, but we understand it's not going to happen anymore. So what we're starting with is the paper documents, or I should say the written documents, not necessarily paper. We have plans to go to audio and video, but as Representative Hilstrom, as you mentioned, we have a whole host of issues that we have to vet regarding not only storage of those, but how long you store them, what kind of data lines we're going to need, because some of these are awfully large videos that isn't like, you know, an email or isn't like something where you send even a 30 or 50 or 100-page document. Video takes up a lot more bandwidth. And so we're sorting through those issues. But we wanted to at least get the start with our electronic content management system that we're going to at least take the written documents, if you will. So right now that's our plan. Again, we're planning to do it. We are going to have a foot in both worlds for the foreseeable future. We're going to have to continue to store paper, and we're going to have this issue of electronic storage of documents as well. So, Mr. Chairman, that's our presentation. I apologize for the video. We'll see if we can get it working by the time we come back the next time.
Yeah. We don't like to quit early, so you're going to have to talk for 45 minutes.
You don't want me to, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hilstrom has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I want to talk a little bit about the video. As we all know, we're getting more and more of it. So when a defendant is in custody and has the right to view their entire file, how do you deal with the issue of the video that has to be, the defendant has the right to review all the video? How do you deal with that issue? Do you bring your own technology with you? Is it provided for you at the jail? How does that work?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Ward.
Senator Representative Hillstrom, I guess it depends on the facility and on the jail. In some jails, there are laptops or there are PCs that we're able to use, and we'll either bring a flash drive or a disk and show the videos to the client in that capacity. In the majority of the jails or facilities that we visit our clients in, we don't have that luxury, so we bring our own. I have a Surface here that does not have an internal audio or video drive, so I have to bring a Surface with an external drive to the jail. Obviously, we need to show the technology that we're using to the jail administrator and get the permission to bring the stuff in. It has not been an issue about asking for the permission to bring it in. What would be wonderful, honestly, what would be wonderful is if we could give the disks or give a flash drive, send it to jail administration to allow our clients to view these things when they have the time while they're incarcerated and waiting for their trial. That becomes a security issue for most jailers. We've been told, and I understand, certainly a disc can be used as a weapon. If they're broken in half, people can use them as weapons for, you know, a fight or what have you. But the chiefs have all worked or are working with jail administration to figure out, is there an alternative? Because it takes a tremendous amount of time for us as lawyers to go to the jail. I don't want that responsibility to fall on our paralegals or investigators, because if questions are asked during the viewing, it's not up to them to answer those questions. So typically, I should say, the majority of the time, it's the lawyers taking that time to do that. So we're looking for an alternative. It's just not easy. Culture change is very difficult as far as trying to do something new, but that's not for a lack of trying.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I only asked that line of questioning because in some cases there may be 20 or 30 law enforcement officers that respond, and then a defendant has the right to view all of the video. So in a case like that, then the public defender would sit with the defendant and view all of that video for the entire time from every single body camera. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair. That is correct. I think that's an extreme. Typically, what we do is we go through all that first in our office, or obviously oftentimes at home. We'll then show it to our clients to show them what we see, what evidentiary value a video or a position of a video might have. But certainly our clients, many of them do ask to look at all of the videos all of the time. I would hope, and this is my own position as a lawyer, I would hope that oftentimes our clients would trust us to show them what the truth is. But as Mr. Kier said earlier, there are concerns about this belief of a lack of transparency, and that accusation goes towards us too. And so there is a desire oftentimes by our clients to want to see every video. And when you say 20, that really isn't an unusual number. I mean, we average in Duluth, I think we've been told, 5 or 6 videos for every single case that's been charged out. And that was for over a calendar year data collecting. And we do download every single one of those videos. We do look at every one of those. It's a matter, I don't mean to belabor it, how much the client wants to see of those videos. But, yes, that's our ethical obligation. Mr. Chair, can I add to that one thing?
Of course.
The important thing to know here in Minnesota is that we clearly are determined to be the custodian of the client's file. It is not our file, and that's a big distinction to other jurisdictions. So it's the client's file. If they want copies, if they want to see it, if they can't possess it because of rules in the jail, but it is their file. So if they make these requests, we have an ethical responsibility to honor those requests and to comply with those requests.
Okay, anything else, your folks? All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm glad we had a good attendance today, because we have the unfortunate task of saying goodbye to one of our fine legal eagles here. Brian Rosenblatt is leading us. We want to thank him for his excellent work and attendance here at the committee. And, Brian, why don't you say a few words, say where you're going, or say goodbye, or whatever you'd like to say.
Sure. I'm going into private practice into a small family law firm near the West End.
Very public defense work?
No. So, thank you.
All right. Well, thanks. Let's get my hand. Okay, thank you, members, and meeting adjourned.